And I think with the women's squad, what we did really, really well was the athlete group would feed back on itself. That feedback would be collated and given back to the athlete group. And then that group would meet every 3 weeks to go through that feedback. And people would have to go, I wrote that. This is why I feel this. And that would get discussed. And at times that was incredibly challenging for young, you know, 20 something athletes. You know, that's, we think as 20 somethings as grown up, they're still on their journey of becoming adults. But it really grows massive qualities and attributes that you will need in order to be successful.
Hello there and a very warm welcome or welcome back to the podcast. My name is Steve Ingham. I'm an applied scientist and leader from the world of high performance sport. And on the podcast, I explore all aspects of human performance, whether that is getting stronger, fitter, mentally more prepared, eating better, playing better, leading and coaching in different ways, but also how we perform in work individually and as teams. And the way I do that is by speaking with great scientists, practitioners, researchers, coaches, athletes, and entrepreneurs. I'm also keen to talk to people from outside of sports, people who are just interested in how we perform as humans. If you enjoy the podcast, then please do share it with friends and colleagues and be sure to subscribe. And if you want to support and champion us, then please do leave a review on iTunes. This week's episode is with Danny Carey. Now, Danny has led and coached the GB field hockey team for over 17 years. He recently coached the men's team to the Tokyo Olympics and is perhaps best known for coaching the women's team between 2005 to the London Games in 2012 and again from 2014 to 2018, leading them to a bronze in London and a wonderful gold medal at the Rio Olympics. What you'll hear from Danny is a thoughtful, considerate, yet performance-focused leader of people, willing to make hard decisions, give clear feedback, and to do what's best, not only for the team, but to be able to turn that focus on himself too, developing himself and his own leadership and performance. So, hi, Danny, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Steve. Yeah, good. I've taken the dog for a walk and got a few calls today, but other than that, I'm pretty relaxed.
Oh, look, I'm super excited to have you on the podcast. So thank you so much for making some time to chat to me. Could you just give me a bit of a background to you? Just kind of give me that origin story. Where did you come from? What was the sort of route into your coaching world?
Yeah, sure. I never intended to work in coaching. I went off to university originally studying information technology and swapped to the sports science course at Loughborough after only a few days, much to the annoyance of my mum and dad, who thought I was giving up the fortunes of information technology. I then became a postgrad at Warwick, and from there I then sought to sort of a fledgling academic career, and I had a post at Brunel University. 6 years there and then 4 years down at the university down in Canterbury. And during that time, my hockey playing career was starting to come to an end, and I was asked more and more whether I'd get involved with coaching. Coached a number of club teams to varying degrees of success in terms of outcome, and then also got involved with the national junior teams around 1997. And really, my academic career, for what it was worth, also gave me a lot of flexibility around my time. I was very much my own boss, other than sort of having to do delivery, you know, writing, research, and such like. So as a result, I just became more and more fascinated in coaching. And then in 2004, I became involved with the England women's program because they were running a very, very big Great Britain program in preparation for Olympic qualification for Athens. And those English players who weren't in the Great Britain squad were sort of being, it was a very small low key program running. And I was involved with that. Then the GB team unfortunately didn't qualify for Athens. the program hockey lost a lot of funding, and then essentially the hockey program almost ceased for a number of months as it sort of sought to understand where it's going to go next. And as part of that, they went out to advert for a new head coach. I remember speaking to the then performance director saying, hey, I'm very young, should I apply? Probably don't stand much of a chance. And he was very honest and said, no, you don't stand a chance, but it'd be good to put your application in, and almost, you know, get used to going through the process. And I think that almost helped my cause, because I was very diligent in my application, but also very relaxed around it, had a very low expectation, ended up going through different rounds. And yeah, and on January the 1st, I was started as the women's national head coach. With the women's program through to 2012. In 2012, I became the performance director of British hockey. So after London Olympics, became a performance director. And then in 2014, for all status of events, took over again as head coach of the women's national team into Rio, and into then a home World Cup 2018. And then after the home World Cup for the women in 2018, took over as the men's national head coach and led that program through to the delayed Tokyo Olympic Games in 21. So 17 years. And now I've resigned and not really quite sure what's next.
Okay, you've given me the full history there. So yeah. That's it. That's a wrap. No,
sorry.
Let's go let's go back to what did you study? What was your what was your educational route, and then what did you actually teach as an academic?
Yeah, so whilst I was at Loughborough, I was very interested in physiology and also the psych. So they were my two majors. My dissertation was in cognitive anxiety, of all things. But interestingly, as a postgrad at Warwick, I moved over into sociology. And in particular, I was interested in two main domains. One of those was around political economy and globalization. And the other was around Olympic bidding processes. So my master's thesis was actually around the Olympic bids of Manchester and Birmingham for 92 and 96 games. And then as part of the focus of that, understanding some of the economics and politics of the Beijing Olympic bid, or they were going through the Beijing Olympic bid. And that then led to me taking a part-time post at Brunel University, which very quickly became a full-time post. And there I taught undergraduate sociology modules and also got involved in the hockey program. So some practical delivery as well as teaching on the undergraduate courses.
Wow. So IT, some physiology, some psychology, and so sociology and economics. Has that an array of studies and breadth been of use to you as you've been searching, I suppose, trying to shore up the quality of decisions or understanding what's going on, the different dynamics? Has that been of use?
I think what has been of use is just when it's overdone, it's not used, but when it's done well, it's been used. It's sort of more, a bit of challenging the status quo, a bit of critical thinking. It's a bit sort of looking at things and just try not to accept that is the way it's done, and that's why, and we always do it that way. That sort of critical thinking that I think comes as part of grounding in good research methodology, but also within critical thinking within sociology. I think that's been a something I've always sort of used within my career. Early on in my tenure, sort of through the Beijing Olympics, you know, I didn't lead well, and that was really a function of almost being still stuck in that, you know, defeat the world through knowledge, right, rather than through sort of also building good relationships. And that's, you know, something. So I was fortunate to overcome that and keep my role and sort of learnt the lessons the hard way through that period.
Could you give me a few examples of that, Danny, just in terms of that initial responsibility of taking on a group, feeling the accountability probably for a lot of hockey fans in the country. What did that lead to in terms of your leadership style early on?
Well, I think, I mean, I was incredibly naive. I was very much around your classic, you know, have a high level of expertise technically and tactically, sort of know the sport. And that's how I viewed my role. My role was to help produce a group of players that technically and tactically knew what they needed to do.
Right.
But of course, taking people on that journey, setting high bars and how you get people to strive towards those high bars is a lot more complex than just understanding the technical and tactical demands of the sport. But I was naive. I didn't really understand or comprehend that. My previous roles didn't really require any kind of meaningful leadership. I had no formal grounding or otherwise in that space. You know, of course, you had been captain of teams and all that sort of stuff, but the reality is that doesn't equip you. You absolutely feel accountable for performance. You know, you stood in Beijing in our first game in Beijing. We lost 5-1 to Germany. It was very late at night, and that can feel very lonely and very crushing when athletes are staring at you and it's like, right, okay, you know, where do we go next? And you're like, okay, well, you feel like you've failed people. And there's been many moments like that over the years, but equally some very incredibly amazing times too.
Can you remember back what differentiated your thinking into, and so crushing defeats, feeling that failure, feeling that responsibility, what stopped you from just trying to crush it with more knowledge or actually think about a blended approach of using that tactical knowledge but also weaving in the artistic team building and leadership?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken about this before, but essentially post the games, as always in Olympic Games, there's a big review process and the feedback was very, very blunt. It was very direct. You know, there were some elements of positivity around really understands the sport, technically, tactically, really, really okay, really good, but leadership zero. And
right.
And it was, you know, it was no holds barred. And, you know, you feel at that time you've given everything, and it can feel incredibly tough. Yeah, really, really incredibly tough. You feel like you really worked as hard as you can for people and for them to write where they did. But of course, they're right, and it is at that point you can either be in denial and anger about it, or you can accept it. Of course. And we can talk about this later on. There are times when sometimes the group that might be providing the feedback has to own their feedback and has to understand it's part of their journey. But at the time, the way that I'd operated with that group, that feedback was completely and utterly warranted. And fortunately, I had a really good boss in David Faulkner, who's a former director, and a really good chair of the board in Philip Kimberley. And because I was kind of accepting of, yes, there's a need to change, they backed me to continue through to London. And then I became absolutely adamant that I would try and do a much, much better job than I'd done through the Beijing cycle.
Okay. So there was part determination, part in your face. It wasn't necessarily just a personal epiphany moment. It was presented back to you fair and square.
Yeah.
But you were supported and encouraged from above to be able to take up that challenge. And how did that feel?
Yes. Good. I mean, at the time, it was brutal. I mean, there's no, obviously people go to war and fight, you know, their lives are at risk. My life wasn't at risk, but, you know, my sense of self, my identity, how much I was invested in it, it felt brutal. And it was staff as well as athletes. And again, they were right as well. One thing that did happen was that I went home that day and my now wife said, well, you're not the person that they've described. So this is, you know, this is a relatively easy fix. And, you know, that sounds an oversimplification, but that was a bit of a, okay, yeah, this is not great feedback. It feels really painful. that actually it shouldn't be too hard a shift to just let people see another side of you. And you have to remember, athletes under pressure, particularly around Olympic selections, major tournament selections, you know, they will, even very good environments, athletes will still read into head coaches and what they're thinking, and they will fill any vacuums with their own assumptions and anxieties. So you can do a very, very good job and still struggle in this space. And that is the reality of the real world, and you have to accept that sometimes as a coach, and just realize you're not going to make everyone love you, and there will be challenges, and it's just how much you're willing to keep going and working through that and accepting and seeing it for what it is.
So there's a couple of dynamics there I'd just like to pick up on. Was that feedback from your now wife a little bit more of a motivation to be more authentic to yourself? You were talking about tactical presentation, understanding the sport. Was that almost what you forced yourself to show, as opposed to actually being a little bit more of your whole self?
I think there's a lot at play when you're a young coach, especially a young national coach, Olympic Games, and what are you falling back on? And often what you're falling back on is how you were coached.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
And if what you perceived was what good coaching was, sort of austere, very, this is the way, and that has been what you perceive as being effective, that's often what you fall back on, despite sort of perhaps some education to the contrary. You can perhaps sometimes fall into the trap of being the persona of people you were coached by. Now, the other thing I would say is that what had got me to become the national head coach, you know, being exceptionally proficient in sort of technically and tactically in the sport, is also what's got you there. So, you know, you will work to that particular strength. But when it's overdone, then of course there's a lack of building relationships. If you've got 30 plus athletes, it can be pretty challenging to build athletes, you know, 30 relationships with athletes that all of them feel equally valued. It is an impossible task. But you can do a much better job than I did through the Beijing cycle.
And so how did you then start? So if you came out of that brutal, candid, emotional feedback about you and how it felt to be led by you, how did you make a change, and what did you do in pursuit of trying to create a different feel in that environment?
Well, I was really aware that, you know, there was essentially some trust had been broken down, especially with some athletes. I think some athletes inherently had a really good relationship anyway. I think they were very, what I would call, mature athletes. They would seek to understand me, even if I weren't, if I wasn't doing a good job the other way around. You know, they would sort of, you know, look beyond some of my sort of serious default face, where I look very serious, very thoughtful, and sort of try and understand my background. Actually, you know, Danny's actually fine. He's so, rather than just making assumptions about what I'm thinking, actually inquiring. And I had a really good relationship with, even through that Beijing period, with some very, 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 very good hockey players. But I also knew that, you know, I'd profoundly broken the trust with some others. And so some, I went out of my way to one athlete in particular, I went and took out for dinner and to apologize really for how I made them feel, sort of opened up and said, look, I'm really wary. I've really, you know, made your Olympic experience not what you wanted it to be, and tried to build bridges, but also knew that, you know, that one act wasn't enough going to be itself. And I had to sort of consistently through the London Olympic cycle just be more myself. And that is sometimes just being very, very thoughtful, very considered about things, quiet, introspective. That's some of my strengths. But equally at times, you know, just living in the moment, having conversations with people about stuff other than hockey. And so over time, just consistently being that way, which I was, and people then, I was then also very explicit about the feedback I was given, and feeding that back to the athletes. I've heard this is what you've said. And then very consistent behavior through that London cycle. And so people became more accepting of who I was, what my strengths were, and working with those strengths rather than try to make me be someone that I wasn't. And I think that's why I then became quite a, I wouldn't say, you know, sweet and harmonious relationship with the athlete right. group. You know, it's a challenging world. It is challenging. But equally one based on sort of mutual trust and respect. When people want you to be something you're not, you've got a decision about whether you're willing to be that or not. And but that wasn't that case through 2012 and 2016. Sort of the athletes knew who I was, the way I operated, what they respected about that, what they struggled with, but understood if they struggled with that, they could get it from somewhere else. And that's why I think that group, that cohort, we had a really successful period.
Mm. And one of the phrases that I know is associated with you is around culture over performance. And how did you balance that as a motivation, as something that you were invested in, that you were creating and that took time over what I think often is in sport is that currency of getting results that just keeps the wolf from the door, just keeps the some people who maybe have to be accountable for sort of the metrics or conversion. How did you balance that?
So I think we have been fortunate or had been fortunate in Olympic hockey in that really our majors, you know, maybe one or two sometimes a year. So you have significant periods of program time to invest in high performance environment and the frequency of it, evolution and iteration, where you can constantly, you know, almost weekly come back and have the conversations about how are we doing on these things? This is how we've discussed we're going to be. And then going out of my way to design or build that into the program. And so I think we're very fortunate in that regard, unlike some of the professional sports where there's more weekly competition, then absolutely there's a consequence to not delivering performance weekly on a weekend, and you may not get the time to build that. I think the skill comes where you're trying to balance the two requirements, and that ultimately, if you believe that culture precedes performance, which I absolutely do, then you're going to find time, even weekly, even when there's match play on a weekend, you're gonna find time, and you can embed it in many, many different and subtle ways. It might be within the practice environment. You can be referring to, you know, the values of the team, the behaviors, the expectations of the team, and even reward those moments within team environments. So you can be skillful about it. You can be nuanced about it, but it is around frequency and intentional effort around those things rather than thinking it's one or the other. But it was easier through the London and Rio Olympic cycles when we didn't have more frequent international competition. In the Tokyo cycle, we had the evolution of the Pro League, and it just became a bit more challenging with much more frequent one-off international matches.
Right. Okay. So what I'm hearing there is that we're setting out a certain environment and certain feel. So you're embedding those norms and those values into the feedback about how do we get on with these tactical aspects in terms of dominating opposition or meters covered, whatever it might be. And also, how do we live our norms and our agreed ways of working? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. And if I bring that to life, often I become very frustrated when I hear sort of football commentators, if I'm blunt, talking about, oh, there's a lack of leadership on the team. You know, it's a very glib statement, which they'll talk about. And then they'll say things like, you know, oh, well, they're just born and you're lucky if you have one. And I really don't believe in that. I think you can systematically go about building people who can lead themselves. They can grip a situation, they can grip others, and therefore you can have a more, to quote Rick Charlesworth, a more leaderful team, a team full of people who are capable of leading around their strengths and skills at any moment in time. And if you value that, which I do, then you design environments that are constantly challenging athletes to do that rather than go inward and internal and understand the problem, probably understand what needs to be done about it, but not willing to actually take action about that. For fear of maybe they thinking they might make the wrong decision or interact with a player in the wrong way. And of course, high performance teamwork that doesn't require that. That requires you to take a risk about your sense of self, to step out of that space. And so if you believe that, then you're going to build that into your daily environment. But it takes time. And unfortunately, one of the things that, one of the biggest challenges of coaching job is to try to help athletes to understand how long it takes. And like everybody, like me, like every athlete, they want it tomorrow. And it doesn't happen tomorrow. It takes months and many years to reach where you want to go. So one of your real challenges as a coach is to raise awareness. It takes time and it's a process and you've got to keep committing to it.
So what I'm hearing there is not the shouty instructions from the sideline, do this, do that, because I know best, I'm the coach, I'm in charge. I'm hearing about put a little bit more intensity or intentional focus into practice so that you're cultivating dynamic decision makers that are fluid and adaptable to whatever play that's emerging. Yeah. as the game might progress, the different opponent set that you might encourage.
I mean, two fantastic examples to bring that to life. We'd spent a huge amount of years preparing for London 2012, literally no stone unturned for London 2012. We were leading Japan 4-0 in the very first game of the Olympics, and Kate, who was our skipper, an incredibly good leader, has her jaw broken in four places by a Japanese player. And the video of that particular moment, which I sometimes show when I'm talking about this concept of developing leaders and the team and people who are going to be willing to step out and actually grip the situation, grip others. When you watch that moment, you see our medical team run on to deal with Kate. And then you see our team and two or three individuals in that team take everybody else away from Kate in that moment. They all come together and there's a conversation about what still needs to happen in the time remaining. So someone's had the presence of mind, and I won't name the individual as well. They have the presence of mind to think, actually, all sitting around Kate in this moment, so there's nothing we can do. And it's also going to detract from what actually needs to happen next in terms of our performance. We've got to trust the medical staff are going to do a really, really good job. And we are mindful enough that some people are going to be a bit all over the place because they've just seen someone's jaw shattered. So, and that's all happening without someone from the side of the pitch going, right, get together, have a conversation, all that sort of nonsense you see sometimes from coaches. So for me, that was a really strange moment. You know, this sort of, in hindsight now, like a very pride moment of all of that work sort of paying off and those individuals understanding what their strengths are and when that becomes appropriate for them to lead. So that's a really good example. You've embedded it, you've worked on it, and then it comes to fruition when it matters most. And then another moment was in the Olympic final in Rio 2016 when we're playing the Netherlands. We'd spoken a lot about the Netherlands' ill discipline and the propensity for kicking the ball away and a little moments that could lead to them getting green cards at critical moments, your last few minutes of the game. Exactly that happened. And then it was about sort of the ability to see and identify that moment and do tactically take advantage of it. And so in that moment, I remember Holly Webb stepping up from a deep defensive role, sort of deep-lying defensive role, and stepping up into a sort of a deep or more attacking midfield role, which created us a little number overload higher up the pitch. And literally in the next play, a little attacking overload into the right-hand side against the Netherlands, penalty corner, equalised. We win the shootout, gold medal. And again, it takes a long time, years, for athletes to appreciate the training environment for those moments. And that's, again, a moment of where someone has gripped the situation, understood what needed to happen in that moment, saw the opportunity, took action, organized others around them, and then allowed that overload to occur. And on that, a gold medal is won. So those moments come from the years, and it is years of work that's put onto the pitch and the frustration of players, why are we doing this type of stuff, you know. But in my experience, and obviously there's a confirmation bias playing out, but in my experience, that is the thing that defines your success. That sort of cultural environment where people lead and lead others in moments of pressure.
Oh, wow. superb examples. I'd love to just explore a couple of the things that emerged from that. One, you talked about your medical staff, your support staff. So you're also thinking about the players in the team, but you're also thinking about the people that might come in to influence, whether it's the analysis, whether it's the nutrition. What are the qualities of the people that you're looking in support of that environment? That would be one question that would emerge from that.
Yeah. And I think towards the end of the Rio cycle, with the help of Andrea First, who was our team psychologist, we did some excellent work about just scratching harder under the surface about how we functioned as a team and what we were like on a good day and a bad day, and therefore what we needed to support each other in those moments. I remember a particular conversation in January 2016. We were in Perth, in Australia, and I had deliberately chosen to take her to a pretty tough environment, summer Australia, incredibly hot, long way from home, living in small little accommodation, not very luxurious, tough test series, lots of players, lots of injuries, deliberately a tough environment, making good decisions about athletes under pressure, but also a real opportunity for Andrea to help facilitate conversations with the staff about, okay, we're working hard about how this athlete group works as a team, what about us? And there were some pretty tough conversations. I remember one member of staff, you know, they took it pretty hard, some of the feedback, but it was given with really good intent and compassion. And I think, well, I know, having conversations with that person subsequently, that, you know, that message after the initial denial and anger bit really hit home, and realized it, they were really valued. It might not have felt like at the time, but they're really valued and what they could bring, but they also just realized they needed to mitigate some elements of their behavior around certain aspects. And Andrew did a really good job around that. And then we, through reflection on that process, we tried to embed that more and more through to the 2018 Women's World Cup and how we operate and function as a staff team. And then subsequently, that's always something that I've been very interested in. But of course, one of the challenges you then face as a head coach, you've got to, like I recently with the men, you know, circa 14 staff, 31 athletes, you know, you've got 45 odd individuals there. And everyone wants to have this wonderful relationship with you at some granular level. At 45, it's very, very difficult to hold true to. So you've got to understand, okay, as a head coach, and I didn't get this balance right, you've got to, you know, where's your priorities lay? Where does the ultimate performance lay? And prioritize a little bit better. I think more recently, sometimes some of my focus has been really probably a little bit too much on the staff team and dynamic, and therefore in subsequent recruitment, you know, is ensuring that those staff are well-developed, rounded individuals who understand their role. They're not needing of the head coach's time and energy. They're going to function with autonomy. And when given autonomy, aren't going to worry about being given autonomy, you know, not having to check everything with the head coach all the time. So that's definitely something I've reflected on in the last few months, really, is just where do you spend your time as a head coach?
And this is just opening up a whole raft of other questions that I've got for you. But what I'm hearing there is that sense of, look, you're going to get feedback. We're going to give it to you in a compassionate way, but it's got good intentions because we want you to be better at your job. So we're investing that emotional effort to try and help you improve. But what you're expecting there is an openness to that, to change and adapt and to respond to that. I think it's, as you know, you talked about that preponderance for tactical, technical knowledge. When you've got support staff, often they come in and lead with that, when actually what you're looking for is the ability to change and adapt and respond to that feedback.
Yes, and I think as part of that, there's a real skill to the process you set up around feedback. So more recently in high performance sport, there's a lot of anonymous surveys. And yeah, I think the intention of that, it's well intended, it's around psychological safety. I would actually argue we need to be really careful that actually what we don't do is undermine some of the qualities and abilities we want in athletes and staff to own feedback and to deliver challenging conversations, because then they have to evidence information And they have to think about how can I best deliver this message in a way that it will be received, rather than putting stuff into spreadsheets anonymously. That doesn't have to be evidence, that doesn't have to be delivered, that doesn't require the skills of courage to engage in a challenging conversation. And so you're not growing people's individuals, you're actually probably unintentionally and probably well-intentionally actually undermining and stunting some of their growth and development. So how people are able to give feedback when it's challenging needs to be considered more, I think. And I think with the women's squad, what we did really, really well was the athlete group would feedback on itself. That feedback would be collated and given back to the athlete group. And then that group would meet every 3 weeks to go through that feedback. And people would have to go, I wrote that. This is why I feel this. And that would get discussed. And at times that's incredibly challenging for young, you know, 20 something athletes. You know, that's, we think as 20 somethings as grown up, they're still on their journey of becoming adults. But it really grows some massive qualities and attributes that you will need in order to be successful. That's my little soapbox there, but I feel quite passionately about it.
It's important. I think, I guess confronting that, the issues, but owning them, doing it in a way that gets practiced so you do get better at it, because if you're the recipient of some feedback that is harsh or developmental, however you want to put it, you're probably going to be then thinking, well, how will I want to present that to other people so that it's more constructively received?
For me, critically also, that it really makes the individual think about what is my intention here? What sits underneath why I'm providing this feedback? Is this really around performance, or is this something that sort of belies a need that is not being serviced, or a want rather than a need from a performance perspective? You know, when people are having to own and objectively evidence what they're saying and why they're saying it, there's a really stop and check moment there. And I think that is a key part of growing up and understanding what it is I'm trying to say here and what is making me think and feel this. Whereas sometimes I feel when there's sort of anonymized feedback, that process doesn't have to happen. People can write stuff and not have to evidence it, objectively provide it, and also grow the skills to deliver that in person. So you've got to go on that journey. You can't just go from nothing to 100%. You've got to take people on that journey. It takes time, but it's certainly something that I think is part of how you develop a performance environment.
I just wanted to take a little break from the conversation just to let you know about our online courses for applied performance practitioners. So the focus of the course is to support professionals who I would say are in the first 10 years of their career, with the aims of cutting through the noise and providing clarity in your work, focusing on what matters most, and developing the right skills to ensure that you're making an impact. There are 5 routes available: strength and conditioning with course tutor of Nick Grantham, psychology with Chris Marshall and Rebecca Levitt, performance analysis with Dr. Sean Allen, nutrition with Dr. Sophie Killer, and myself leading the physiology route. The course will be delivered through 10 one-hour lessons, and you'll have lifetime access to the courses, plus community access where you can interact with other students, tutors, watch the replays of all the previous Supporting Champions webinars and summit presentations. If this course is for you, then take a look at supportingchampions.co.uk/online course, and all the courses are there and available. So look, we've had amazing feedback about the impact of this course. You can read some of the feedback on the course pages, and we're really excited about working with a new group of applied professionals aiming to take their practice with athletes and coaches to the next level. You mentioned something earlier, and I've just got a hint of a tension or a dynamic that you've felt. Stop me if I'm barking at the wrong tree here, but this idea of actually investing and dialing up the team building and the culture and so on. You talked about having 45 people on a team, and you know, that's quite a high burden for you as a leader to be worrying about every interaction or dynamic. I'm hearing that sense of a little bit of, you know, what's the quote? You can't please all the people all the time. You can please some of the people some of the time, etc. Is that a sense of look, you've got to bear this yourself. You can't necessarily have to do all of it as a leader, and you've got to expect other people to step up too.
Yes, and as Katie Warriner, who had I had the absolute pleasure of working with, is, when she was psychologist for the men's program, she would often say to me, you know, sometimes as a leader, if you believe in something, you stand up for it. You know, that's not gonna land well. But that is, if you have the courage of convictions, you have to hold true to them. And as a result, sometimes you're gonna annoy, upset, and frustrate people. But that comes with the territory. And I do think some of the discourse around coaching and leaders doesn't discuss that. And it's almost this sort of all leaders have somehow got to reach everybody on a level that, you know, is almost, I think, impossible to achieve. So I think what we did or tried to do, and I think at times did exceptionally well, especially through the work of Katie Warriner and Tim Pitt, the two psychologists involved with the men's program, was unearthing people's histories, their biographies, and sharing with them group, building more mutual trust, and people understanding where others are coming from and why they act and behave the way they do. So yes, absolutely spend time investing in that, and then look to develop more leaders and try to build processes that essentially require people to step into those spaces of leading. And again, that has to be skillfully and well thought through. Ultimately, people will then succeed or fail about whether they will step into those spaces. There's the adage of you can lead a horse to water, but will it drink? You know, you can keep providing those opportunities, keep putting it at the front of things. And I think that's something that we did well through the work of Katie and Tim. And then ultimately, athletes succeeding or failing and staff succeeding or failing will depend on people taking the step.
Mm. So it might be a little bit too crass for me to ask you to compare and contrast 2012 cycle and result versus 2016. Obviously, different colour medals, but can you make any? And I must acknowledge you've already been self-aware enough to sort of say, look, there's a confirmation bias as to must have all been good for 2016. But so. Is there anything that you can pick out that you've got some tangible evidence behind that was different in terms of how you worked or how the team worked?
So, again, I can't objectively say this was the thing, but...
So let's say the subjective there.
Subjectively. So in 2012, and I don't mind sharing this, 2012 was really the absolute pinnacle for me. That was a medal absolutely through hard work by design. 2014 to 2016, when I took over, there was a lot of holy moly, we've got about 18 months to get ready for Rio. There's a lot of stuff that we needed to kind of get a grip on and handle on. One of the big reflections I had from 2012, reading through the feedback, which was in high contrast to the feedback from 2008, but a lot of the athletes spoke about, we were incredibly well prepared, and we knew exactly what to do under different circumstances. So as a coach, you can read that and go, oh, brilliant, did a great job. But it was the phrase around, we knew exactly what to do, that really got me thinking about why we lost the semi-final to Argentina. We lost a heartbreaking semi to a very good Argentina side, containing probably the best player the world has ever seen in Luciano Aymar. And it was crushing. The reality was they scored early and then they scored another goal in contentious circumstances. We got a goal back, but we couldn't do enough to break them down to get the equaliser. And for me, it was a case of we were a little bit too predictable in our play. And so that we knew exactly what to do. there just needed to be sort of harnessing the strength of that whilst also just allowing a little bit more, a little bit more license for players to go off script. And so this isn't the one thing that was the difference between 2012 and 2016, but I think it on the pitch, it was slightly different between 2012 and 2016. The way that we coached the athletes was, these are the principles of play. Know these principles of play. They inform your decisions under pressure. If we know them and we can consistently make good decisions under pressure, we'll do really, really well. However, there is an element of license to break the principles of play if there's a better solution. And we had a few players who in that bracket had a little bit more license around breaking the principles of play. And in the Olympic final, there were two moments where you could almost argue someone went a little bit off script. And that script can be your absolute strength. You know, it gives you real clarity of team understanding. What's my teammate going to do here? So if people are always going off script, there's just no understanding. But if there's enough wriggle room that, okay, there's a better opportunity here, the better moment, and it's not being gung-ho with breaking the script, then take it. And I think that was a slight difference between the gold medal winning team on the pitch and the bronze medal winning team on the pitch between London and Rio. Some of that is just a function of the players involved. And some of that was, there was a little bit more in the license in the coaching to go, yes, that is the expectation here. These are our principles, but also, if you can see an opportunity there, okay. Not all of the time, like, otherwise it's just chaos. People don't understand what your teammates are doing.
Yeah, okay. So a calculated risk, effectively. So
we're
calculating the formations, tactical awareness, the patterns of play that we're well drilled on will serve as the base to allow us to unlock something that will be very difficult for a team to predict.
And of course, then you've got humans interacting in all of that. You've got some players who actually probably their strength is they really understand the system and they can really deliver on it. And it opens up spaces and opportunities for other people who possibly have different sets of skills that can go and exploit some of those off script moments. And some people can get really on board with that and others can rail, well, why can't I do that? And they can. Sort of that sense of unfairness and having those types of conversations with players about, you know what, this is what you're world leading at. This is the value you bring to the team. Do this for the team. And it allows some of those players to do some of these things, which they are world leading at, and trying to have those types of conversations. Mm-hmm. Whereas sometimes players don't accept that I don't make world-class passes frequently, but I want to make them. Actually, that's not what you're in the team for. Your team is to just make consistently good decisions, defend really, really well. You don't need to be making these world passing players to be valued, world class passer to be valued, but they struggle with that. I want to have impact. And I heard that term so often as a coach. I want to have impact. Do the right thing.
Did you have any different mantras or approaches for the different cycles you've been through?
Post Beijing, I had I still use it, a little mantra, which is WAIWAT, which I'm sort of quoting on a little bit nowadays, which is where am I, where are they? To bring that to life, any interaction, especially under pressure, is, you know, how am I feeling? Tired, anxious, nervous, upset, angry, over the top, elated. And where are they? Where are they? And then almost the secondary question is, where do I need to be? So I remember just before the Olympic shootout in Rio, coming down, thinking, actually feel quite good about this. I feel like we're really, really well prepared. Looking at the Dutch, they look broken psychologically, like we were always going to win the shootout. And then I was thinking, so, okay, where am I? I'm actually in the right place. Where are they? Actually looks like the athletes are in the right place too. So really good. But interestingly, some of the staff had been pitch side I felt probably they weren't in the right space. They were like, you know, shoot out, woo, you know.
Right.
So it was a bit like, okay, the athlete group are good. I just need to kind of just keep a bit of a handle on the rest of the staff group. And in fact, Kate, who's the skipper, came and had almost a similar conversation with me, saying, right, athletes are really good, but some of the staff need to just calm down a bit. And so that why what mantra is something I use a lot, especially at things like Olympics, when you're absolutely, you know, if relatively sleep deprived, you've been in a holding camp for 2 weeks, you're then in Olympic Games for another 2 weeks, you know, you've lived cheek by jowl, it's not a day off, you know, it's, you can get into potentially a poor performance environment as a coach. So where am I? Where do I need to be? Where are they? Where do they need to be? A little mantra I carry.
So I love that. Did it stand up all the way through the shootout? Did it weather the storm? Did you hold that
for me? For me, yeah, absolutely. So ironically,
it didn't for me. I needed that just watching it.
So ironically, two things happened. One is the athlete group that were taking the shootout all. We'd rehearsed our processes, and a part of that involved like how that group taking the shootout stood and worked with each other. And as a result, they stood about 20 meters in front of me, directly in front of me. So I couldn't actually see the shootout happening. So I'm with the rest of the squad thinking, I can't really see what's going on here. So, you know, and so there's a great photo of everyone sort of jumping up as a goal's gone in, or the gold medal winning goal from Holly Webb. And I only knew that when everyone else jumped up, and then I jump up, you know, but the photos looks like I'm just still stood there because I don't know if he scored or not. So, it was an interesting moment.
So I'd be keen to ask you about how it actually felt in the moment and afterwards, but I'm also curious to pick up on that point about self-management around looking after yourself, during the big moments, during the pressure, during the high workloads, as well as handling the pressure. So maybe if you could just riff on how it actually felt afterwards, and the legacy of it, really.
Yeah. So if I'll come back to Rio, and I'll talk about Tokyo now. So Tokyo Olympic Games, you know, delayed by a year, trying to prepare a team through restrictive protocols, you know, small training groups, no contact, and then very limited international match play. We weren't allowed to cut the squad size down because it wasn't seen as morally a good thing to do, cutting the squad down. You know, people during the lockdown and pandemic saying, sorry, you're surplus to requirement. You know, it's just not morally a good place to be, but it meant a very large squad. So numbers, you know, become more challenging to handle, all those relationships, particularly around people wanting to feel valued. Going into the games itself, the International Olympic Committee, I mean, it was ridiculous. Suddenly changed the regulations around some of the pre-accredited reserves. Traditionally, they could only come into our squad if there was a medical injury that meant that person injured could no longer take part in the tournament. Literally, a few days before the Olympics, they changed the regulations. We'd done all of our work with our traveling reserves around, you're traveling, it's going to be really tough, but you can't take place. To all of a sudden, they're like, can I play now? Because you could be subbing people in and out of reserves. I took the decision that we selected a squad and worked with that squad because of the permutations and the skills and quality of that squad. And if they were fit and healthy, we were going to stay with that squad. And I would still make that decision now, given the athlete group, given the skills and quality, I would still make that decision. But obviously if you're an athlete who's a traveling reserve, it's difficult enough. And then when the regulations change, and then you're just like, okay, maybe I am going to get to play. Oh no, now the coach is now saying I'm not going to get to play. You know, they can rail against that. I found that incredibly challenging, but what I did do well was decide that I'm not going to be able to resolve that person's emotions. One of those individuals is going to be unhappy. And there's little or nothing I can do about that. If I sense it's going to impact detrimentally on other athletes in the village, then I'll intervene. Otherwise, trust the athlete group to manage that individual. So that is a lesson I'd learned from previous, where I'd ruminate too much on, you know, athletes are unhappy. Mm. And I look back on that, and ironically, it was incredibly tough for those individuals, like unbelievably tough. You know, you imagine you've trained all those years, you travel all the way to Olympics, but you're not going to get to play. I mean, I can't begin to imagine how tough that is. Equally, your job there is to have the courage and convictions and trust what you've invested in the time and energy and process and the conversations you've had. And now, therefore, your job is to keep your focus where it needs to be, and that is on those playing and what needs to happen. And I look back and I think I actually did, actually pretty pleased with how I, you know, where am I? This is, I would rather this not be the case. Is there much I can do about it? No. Okay, accept it. You know, really accept it. It is what it is. Trust the athletes will deal with it and keep and do a really good job by those who are playing. And that's something that I look back and think it was incredibly tough, but I did a good job. I'm sure in the eyes of the athletes involved, those reserves, maybe not. But it's a tough world. Rio and the gold medal moment, this is going to be a bit hard maybe to comprehend for the viewers or listeners. I'll try to put it in terms that maybe make some sense, but for how was that 2016, so I started in 2000, so that's 11 or 12 years of work there. And for probably 80% of those athletes, I've worked with that same cohort, and there have been tremendous ups and downs and really incredibly tough moments, incredibly good moments. And I have spent every day looking backwards at what's just happened and then looking to what's going to happen. So literally every waking moment, like, what, you know, review, what do we do, what's good, what's bad, what needs to develop, and then what does that mean for the future? So literally every moment. And all of a sudden, the shootout goes in. You've just won Olympic gold medal as a group of athletes. You've kind of hit something you've been aiming for, and you're like, what next? Like, because you've spent forever in this mode of looking backwards, then looking forwards, and not like, woohoo, we've won, we've done it. That was my response. And I was really, I felt incredibly proud, but I was also incredibly like trying to process it, like, wow, we've done it. But it was really trying to process it, let it sink in. And I remember the day after, again, something I've spoken about before, but I remember the day after, all of the staff and athletes, quite rightly, are going absolutely large in Rio de Janeiro, you know, off the Ipanema beach and Christ in Redeemer, and, you know, not going to the bed and partying pretty hard. I spent the day in my room writing a great big mind map. And that isn't, I'm not, that's really sad indictment of where I was. I should have been out celebrating and living, you know, smelling the roses in the moment. But I was just struggling to process everything and also trying to make sense of, well, we've done it. What does this mean? So I was just classically, why did we win and how are we going to win again? Because that's what I'd known for 11 years. Okay. I could struggle to just go, brilliant, right, let's just go and celebrate. I didn't have that capacity. So I don't say that as a, you know, that's good, what a good coach does. I actually tell it as the opposite. You know, I didn't have the skills of, all right, let's just go and celebrate. Because I just didn't have the capacity to do that.
It sounds like you were feeling the tension of, why am I feeling like this? Or why can't I? In the moment of jubilation or celebration, you are having an internal tension as to, well, I don't want to do that. I want to do something else to come to terms with or accept and understand it yourself.
Yeah, and I'd really labour. I was really happy and really, really proud. But my way of processing what happened was to almost like, well, why did we win? Get that all down on a big mind map. And then how are we going to win again? Get that all down on a big mind map. Because that's kind of where the way I'd existed for 11 odd years at that point in time. So, yeah, I was incredibly proud of those group of athletes and of the staff, and incredibly a sense of incredible accomplishment. But that manifested itself in a way that often I think other people looked at and go, well, why isn't Danny and, you know, in the bar with everybody else. It's not because I'm a miserable scroat. It's just because I was trying to comprehend it all.
And did you get past the miserable scroat bit, or did you ruminate to a point where you'd processed it that allowed you to do something different? Was this a, because I sometimes call the sort of post-Olympic lull the jubilant grieving, where we're experiencing this high, but we're also quite down because it's all over, and now we're looking at the next goal and we're a little bit miserable that we've got to crack on. And so there's that stage of processing. Did you get past that, and how did that feel?
I remember coming home and then driving all the way to South France with my family, which is a long drive down to the Mediterranean. And that was brilliant because it just sort of a completely different environment, different people. And it just allowed me, especially the drive, allowed me just to sort of process stuff and driving, and also not people who wanted to talk about Rio. You know, so it just allowed me a bit of space. But you're absolutely right. What I think people don't really comprehend is how long that process takes. You know, I remember recently coming back from Tokyo, and I won't name names, but someone said to me, "Oh, I really respect how much you've taken some time off, and you know, you must be good to go now." And I'm like, you know, a 2-week holiday, it doesn't scratch the surface. You know, the reality is it's months of kind of coming to come to terms and decompressing and working through, especially through that pandemic. You know, it's months of getting your head back in a reasonable space of being. And I think we do a good job with the athletes around understanding that and giving them space and time. So in the hockey group, you know, we basically told them to disappear until January. It's not the same with the staff group. We're back in, you know, a few weeks later. And, you know, that possibly needs some reflection.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. And so what's your now perspective, given you've had a bit of time beyond the world of hockey? What do you hope is the legacy from all of this work?
I think it must happen in a number of sports where, you know, new leadership comes in, and I think really good leaders coming in try and embrace the really good stuff of the past and evolve the bits that need to evolve. So you get evolution rather than stagnation. There is always pressures on the Olympic programs, external pressures for change and how it impacts on different stakeholders, and hockey, like most sports, is facing those pressures. Hockey has probably had its most successful period ever, including the men's period, sort of 88 era. And so there's some needed evolution, and I'm sure that will happen with new leadership. What I really hope is that it embraces the stuff that made it successful and evolves, rather than new broom, everything that we did before is wrong and it all gets thrown out. I don't think that will happen. I hope it won't happen. But I think we learned so much through those Olympic cycles about how you create environments, how you train, the session design, the learning methodology, the review processes, the leadership, the culture environment. And one of the things I am proud about is the women's program still holds the vision, values, and behaviors work, the cultural work that they did through the Rio cycle is still the backbone of the cultural work now. And so that's now second or third coach since I've left. And I think that is a sign of an organization that's mature enough to hold on to what is good while still evolving where it needs to evolve.
I'm hearing almost a simile there with the tactical play on the field, in terms of we know how to control situations, or we've got a rigid, we've got some patterns of play that we can rely on, but when we need to go wild or we need to sense an opportunity, we can and we can react to it.
Yes, and I think good performance planning is similar. It's like there is a real strong sense of direction, but rather than being therefore blind to opportunities that come along the route of that sense of direction, a really good performance planning doesn't rigidly hold to the plan when other opportunities present themselves. And I'd like to think that that will happen now in the years to come for hockey.
So you say you've gone solo now. So what are you up to? What are the challenges that you've got in front of you?
Paying the mortgage.
Paying the
mortgage. So yeah.
Find someone to do that for you.
Yeah. Getting up in the morning and not having the certainty that I'd had previously, like literally knowing, you know, for the next few weeks, months, years, exactly what was coming down the road, not knowing about that. So dealing with uncertainty and almost embracing it a little. And then what have I been up to? I've done lots of little days here and there of consultancy. So I've worked in three different bodies within football, Premier League, the LMA, and the FA. I've done some work in rugby, some really fascinating work with Hong Kong rugby, about to do some work with England rugby. And I've also been dipping my toe into corporate world. So I've been doing some leadership development work with the FTSE 100 company. That's been fascinating. It's my first sort of delving into that. So uncertain genuinely of what the future holds for me. I've deliberately taken the view that sort of try everything, you know, be open to it. And I've had lots of amazing conversations with people who've been really good at giving their time. And just taking the approach of try everything, don't discount anything. But there is an element of anxiety in me. There's an element of, right, you know, opportunities, you can see them come and go. And like, how many do I let come and go before deciding I really need to just nail something a little bit more down? Or do I just stay more in this sort of solo consultancy space? Not sure that's me. I like a sense of belonging. I like a sense of being involved in a project with people going towards something. But that could just be because that's my comfort blanket. That's what I've done for 17 years. So I'm uncertain at the moment, Steve, if I'm honest.
Oh, well, I've no doubt that the feared and powerful, but also thought-provoking philosophical approaches that you bring that are burnished in that Olympic environment, it would be very powerful for people to draw upon for their own performance. So no doubt that you'll succeed in that wherever you go. So thank you so much for sharing your insights, Danny. I've really, really appreciated it.
Well, thank you, Steve, for inviting me on. It's I hope people find something somewhere in amongst all of that. So thank you.
And so if people want to get in touch or follow you on various different platforms, where's best to go, Danny?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Probably they can find me on LinkedIn. If they want, if you just type Danny Carey into LinkedIn, or Daniel Carey, probably Danny Carey, you can find me on LinkedIn.
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you. Yeah, they can find me on there if people are interested and want to reach out. So, yeah, thank you for that, actually, Steve.
Brilliant. Thank you, Danny.
You're welcome. No worries.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. I really hope you enjoyed this week's conversation. Now, we've got plenty more to come, so if you'd like to support and champion us, then take the time to subscribe and leave a review on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or wherever you tune in. You can also give us a follow on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. All the links are in the show notes. So in the meantime, have a great week.